It was about 18 months ago when Mary Hill bought the right to pick a service topic, a whole sermon topic from me, from the church auction. Now, usually when someone does this, they have a topic clearly in mind, but Mary wasn't totally sure. It took her a few months to decide. It was a few months later, we were over dinner in downtown Denver, and it came to her. See, we were in Denver that night because we were lucky enough to be among those that got to see the musical based on the life of Alexander Hamilton when it came through. I know, you're jealous. It was awesome. So we were sitting there talking about the show and our favorite parts, the inspiring ambition and strong will that Hamilton had, his determination, all represented in that theme song where he declares, "I'm not throwing away my shot." Right? "That's what I want my sermon to be about," Mary said. "Not throwing away your shot." I nodded and immediately tried to figure out who in the congregation could pull off that rap. But then, a few months later, life happened. Mary got a crappy cancer diagnosis. And before long, her life was all about treatments and pain management, all the crappy stuff that goes along with that. Which is why I started to think about her request a little bit differently. I started to think about the double meaning of that song, "Not Throwing Away My Shot." As you might know from the musical or from your high school history class, two literal shots, like gunshots, change the course of Hamilton's life. First, a shot that killed his son, Philip, in a duel. And then the shot that killed Hamilton himself, also in a duel. So what happens to our ambition, our will, when life doesn't go the way we thought? Like, it's not that we threw away our shot, it's that the shot wasn't what we thought it was going to be. Life happens, and we are helpless to fix it. Sean was getting at some of this last week, but it's not just at the end of life that we have to deal with our helplessness, it's our whole lives. Now, these questions, and also just a little bit that I wasn't sure I could think of anybody that could pull off the rap, are why I decided to anchor the service today, not in that song about throwing away your shot, but in a different song about helplessness, really, a song called "It's Quiet Uptown." To introduce the song, I want to invite John Hill up. He's going to set the context. John is Mary's husband and a professor of theater, so I thought he'd be the perfect person to do this part.
Thank you, Gretchen. So here we are in the middle of Act Two of the musical Hamilton, when Alexander Hamilton's son, Philip, accepts the invitation to a duel. Hamilton and his wife, Eliza, have been somewhat estranged at this point because Hamilton was obsessed with his work, but he was also having an affair. And she did not become aware of it until Hamilton publicly confessed this affair. Hamilton had advised his son that no one really shoots in a duel. You'll be fine. But it wasn't true. Philip was shot, and he dies with his father by his side, his father feeling helpless. This song, "It's Quiet Uptown," comes right after that moment, as Hamilton tries to make sense of the senseless. And as the song says, learn to live with the unimaginable.
A few years ago, my mom decided to reclaim her attic, which meant that on one random day, I received these three large boxes delivered by FedEx, filled with random remnants of my childhood. My sisters each received their own version. One of my favorite finds in those three boxes was a small purple Hello Kitty diary. It represented a small little entry from each of my third and fourth grade years. Every entry is equally fascinating and horribly embarrassing. One standout, equally fascinating and embarrassing, was an angry note, frustrated tale of me trying to teach my little sister how to ride a bike. She was 2.5 years younger than me. I was 8 at the time, according to the entry, which made her not yet 6. Dear diary, it reads, my sister is so ungrateful. I tried to teach her how to ride a bike today. She won't listen. She was so cranky. I was just trying to help. I go on from there. I decided my sister was destined to never ride a bike. She was a bad listener. And she was mean and stupid. I mean, I was only 8, but I think this is pretty much how most of us react when confronted with our own helplessness. We get angry or frustrated. We blame. I mean, maybe we lecture or criticize, over-explain. Help is about connection, but helplessness cuts that connection off. We take our helplessness personally. Like, in my mind, my sister hated me, rejected me. Her inability to take my help, it must be about something to do with me. Or she was particularly stubborn and mean and stupid. I mean, I was helpless because of her. Helplessness feels personal, even though almost always helplessness has more to do with stuff that's going on that has nothing to do with us in the particular. Like a developmental stage that wasn't yet ready to ride a bike, for example. I wanted to start here because helplessness, I think, is not just a matter of life's most extreme situations, like losing a child or a cancer diagnosis, let alone a duel. Helplessness is, as I said, it's regular, it's daily, it's familial. It's our good advice that our friends won't take. It's our aging parents. It's us aging. And helplessness is depression. It's overwhelm. It's stress. Helplessness is addiction or illness. Helplessness is debt. It's the job that our partner can't find. It's the scrolling through the news on autopilot, seeing in an instant one unimaginable thing after another. That's helplessness. And helplessness is when that news gets personal, like with our compa, the woman that some of our members are accompanying as she awaits decision on her asylum case. So many experiences of helplessness. Helplessness is born in compassion, though. It starts in the hope, that hope to fix, to heal, to pick up all the broken pieces, grab the glue, and get to work. It's why helplessness can be so painful, such a shock, you know, when we come with all of our good intentions, our offering of a blessing, and we find instead this rejection, this unwillingness, this impossibility. We find the limits of what we can and cannot control. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things that I cannot change. I'm guessing many of us know this prayer that was written. It was written by Reinhold Niebuhr in the 1940s. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things that I cannot change, the courage to change the things that I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. It became this prayer connected to the work of Alcoholics Anonymous as they embraced that critical first step of sorting out what is within and beyond our control. that discerning work to not over or underestimate what's within our own power to help, which it turns out we're not always all that great at, right? I mean, our brains trick us to believing that we can fix something that we actually cannot, or just as much we believe that we have no agency and no power, when actually there's a lot we might be able to do to help. Learned helplessness is a psychological term for those times when we feel helpless, but actually we aren't. Learned helplessness, it can be the result of trauma, like when we experience something that's extremely painful, that's beyond our control, that we don't have control over, and then we apply that feeling of powerlessness broadly. It doesn't have to come from trauma, though. One study I read about learned helplessness talked about how students who don't do well on math tests, for example, which is not mostly traumatic, right? Students who don't do well on math tests can come to and have that feeling of helplessness arise whenever they do anything related to math. Learned helplessness is an overgeneralization of our sometimes real helplessness. It's a flawed reading of reality, and even more, it's a breakdown of our imagination. We can't imagine all that is possible, all the ways that we might still be able to act, all the ways that life might remain available to us, that life is still becoming in that experience of helplessness. Life feels like it's constricting. We're constricting. Pessimism has a very strong correlation to the feeling of helplessness. Writer Parker Palmer talks about being caught in this sort of helplessness as a major component of his experience of depression. No matter what he did or what help other people tried to offer him, he just could not pull himself out. He felt entirely helpless. He says people would come to him and say, "Why are you sitting here being so depressed? It's beautiful outside. Just go outside, feel the sunshine, smell the flowers." Or they'd say, "You're so successful. You've written so well. I mean, why are you depressed?" Now, next week in our Easter service, we're going to explore what help that is helpful actually looks like. But this is a little spoiler alert. Trying to argue someone out of their pain is not usually experienced as helpful. Right? That kind of admonishment usually just makes people feel worse. As Palmer says, of course he knew intellectually that it was beautiful outside and that the flowers were lovely and fragrant, but he just couldn't feel it in his body, which made him start to feel like a fraud, which in turn just made him start to feel even more helpless. His friends and family, I'd imagine, they were also feeling pretty helpless around that time. I mean, this incredible person who they loved, who had so many gifts to offer the world, just seemed caught and disconnected. They wanted to do something to try to make it better, to make him better. They had to be able to fix it, or at least get him to fix it. It isn't really a thing, as far as I can tell, but I feel like this should be called our learned overhelpfulness. Because just as much we are taught these things too. Conditioned across our lives to try to save or fix, or at least keep trying to fix, far beyond what is actually ours to fix or control. Hardly any of us, on the other hand, are taught to give up, taught to accept things as they are, taught to let go in the midst of struggle. We aren't taught to pause, to look around, and to wait in the midst of that struggle. That is, to be patient, to see what could happen that is not through our own doing, our own fixing, our own helping. The experience of helplessness is often an invitation to patience. Realizing that help often doesn't come on our own private timetable, or in the way we'd like it to come. Helplessness invites us to be present, and open to all we don't know. Open and present to the other, to their suffering, and to grow in empathy. And helplessness invites us to be open and present to ourselves, to our own suffering, our own pain. Often when we're trying to help someone else after all, especially when we're trying to overhelp them, our own pain is at play. Some feeling that we don't want to feel. Some experience we're trying ourselves not to have. A deep need that is just ours, that we're trying to meet. A need to be needed or to do whatever need it is that we've somehow locked in ourselves to be connected to our own sense of worth. So it's only when we pause in the middle of these feelings, this helplessness, and get in touch with those needs, can we breathe into the possibility of letting go. Breathe into the love that holds us, regardless of our doing or our fixing, our worth that is regardless of how helpful or how helpless we may be. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things that I cannot change, the courage to change the things that I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Palmer did eventually receive help that was helpful during that time of depression from a friend that came and offered him something that most of us wouldn't think of as helpful. Every afternoon, he would come and sit with him and, with his permission, take off his socks and shoes and massage his feet. His friend hardly ever said a word during these visits. He'd offer no advice. He wouldn't even offer encouragement. He would just occasionally say, "I can feel your struggle today." He would just report back from time to time on what he was intuiting his friend was feeling. There is something about being seen fully in our helplessness that helps us see more fully. We can't be argued out of our helplessness, but we can be seen in our struggle. And being accepted in that helplessness, seen for what we are, somehow helps us to see more fully the help that is available, both beyond and within us. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things that I cannot change, the courage to change the things that I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. It's not actually about knowing, I don't think. In my experience, sorting out what things we can change and we cannot change, what things we can help and that we cannot, it's not really about knowing, at least not in the usual way we think about knowledge, as in facts, figures, reason. Because sometimes we can know exactly what we cannot change, and yet we cannot know it at the same time. Sometimes the knowing is too much. We close off, we shut down. And sometimes the knowing in those moments overtakes us, and we go the other way, so that helplessness turns to surrender, and we fall into the arms of whatever might be able to hold us, and we pray. Like Alexander Hamilton and his wife in those days following their son's death, we surrender to the quiet and we try to learn to live with the unimaginable. In these moments, I've come to think of the task of helplessness as less a matter of knowing and more a matter of an invitation to the practice of forgiveness. As in, can we forgive life for not going the way we had planned? Can we forgive ourselves for not being able to stop it or fix it or save it, whatever it is? Can we forgive our limitations, our humanness? And can we forgive everyone else their limitations, their humanness. This sort of forgiveness is a practice that psychologist and Buddhist teacher Tara Brach talks about as the beginning of a radical form of acceptance, which is not, by the way, the same as saying that everything is okay, right? That we're somehow good with it. This is important because we can get stuck here thinking that if we accept something, it means that we agree with it, that we think it's okay, that it's we're condoning it. But acceptance is not the same as agreement. Acceptance is a practice that invites us instead to release ourselves from judgment, to release ourselves from that disconnection that often happens in the midst of our helplessness, to free ourselves from the hardening and shutting down from life, and instead free ourselves into compassion, a radical compassion. Acceptance and then the forgiveness that brings us to it is a practice of softening rather than hardening our hearts, so that we can free ourselves into the blessing that remains always available, so that we can be present to the gift of life that is always available, even now. Just about 13 years ago, my partner and I brought home a 2-day-old baby girl from the hospital. It was what they call a high-risk placement. So that meant that her birth mom still had parental rights, but we were eager to become parents. We had every hope that she would stay. But that meant that we were extremely aware of our own helplessness. As in every call that came through, we thought it would be the one where they would say, nope, we're coming to get her. She doesn't get to stay. So the way we dealt with this helplessness was by taking up a very important and serious task called worrying. Right? Sometimes worry works like this, like as a proxy for being able to do something when we know we can't do anything. Like a task that signals to ourselves and the world, we may not be able to stop that bad thing from happening, but we can worry about it. We lived a little on edge all the time. We wouldn't let our friends buy us anything, and we didn't want to name her or act like she was going to stay. Imagine the heartbreak, we thought. I mean, if she has to leave and we're left with all her stuff, we couldn't. So a couple weeks after we picked her up, I was talking to my sister, that same one who refused to learn how to ride a bike. I was telling her how we knew that she might not get to stay, and so we were being careful not to love her too much. She responded with a real sisterly love, "That is so stupid." To her, she said, "You're already her mom's. You can try to be all distant, but you'll miss out on what's happening right now. And if she doesn't stay, your hearts will still be broken." And then she made me a deal. She said, "How about if I take your worry for you? I'll worry for you every day. So you know it's taken care of. And you don't have to do it. And instead, you can just love her and name her and be her mom's right now." Some call this invitation that my sister made to me a worry fast. Like when we actively choose not to worry for some period of time, we just choose not to. Worrying keeps us locked into the future, after all, future that may or may not arrive, and it keeps us disconnected from what's happening right now. When we let go of worry, we radically accept what is. Regardless of whether we can control it or change it or fix it, we accept this moment right here as it is. We forgive and accept ourselves as we are, and we open ourselves instead to the beauty and the grace that has been there all along. Now, even without someone else being willing to take on your worries, you too can go on a worry fast for an hour, if you can make it that long, or a whole day. Whatever break you'll let yourself take so that you can be fully present to this. A couple days after that call with my sister, we held our baby in our arms. We were sitting at the kitchen table, and we lit a little candle, and we named her. Gracie Yella, it means she who is a gift. Every day, in some ways that are catastrophic, and in more often ways that are casual and regular, life offers us these moments where we get to experience our helplessness. We get to experience giving up. We get the chance to give up and let go and forgive everything. This chance to stop worrying and radically accept life just as it is, right now, even when we find ourselves face to face with the unimaginable. And in that giving up, we have the chance to receive this gift, this grace that is always here, this help that holds us and connects us, this help that, as Anne Lamott said, 100% of the time is always on its way. May it be so, and amen.